democracy, the power of her voice in her town, the power of her voice as a little girl, una niñita. And what she says, actually, when she was at the rally at the Capitol in Austin, leading a rally of hundreds of people, she said, I have to speak because my friends don't have a voice anymore. And so she has taken this, and I have hopes for Caitlin in terms of her life, but also she's a kid dealing with severe PTSD and wasn't able to get the mental health treatment that she needed in Uvalde, so now her family has to travel to San Antonio to get her the EMDR therapy that I can tell you is working, because when I first met Caitlin in January, she was quite withdrawn, and when I was last with her a couple of weeks ago, she's much more open. Of course, I'm very worried about her and her family as the anniversary comes on May 24th.
Can you talk about the message that her mother got, that so many parents got? It was a recorded message on the phone on that day, 1 year ago tomorrow, 1 year ago Wednesday, as she thought her, you know, her little girl, her Caitlin, was just enjoying fourth grade that day.
So it's, here's what you need to understand. There's a dynamic in Uvalde where the ethos is that they are being surrounded and constantly challenged by undocumented immigrants because they're an hour away from the border. And you're like, what does this have to do with this? Well, there were school shutdowns in Uvalde about every week leading up to the shooting. So why? Because there were car police chases chasing what they say are undocumented immigrants. I was not able to document this part of the story, but there were school shootings that happened, school shutdowns that happened all the time. And so that message, you know, there's a shutdown, everything is okay, it was par for the course. In fact, the only pediatrician in the town, when he got that message, it was like, oh, it's just another, you know, another shutdown because there's a car chase happening with the Border Patrol. And so that was what was repeated to the parents, that everything is okay. It was not okay. The police did arrive within about 3 minutes. The problem is that when they heard, and we documented this along with the Texas Tribune, when the police heard and understood that the assailant had an AR, an automatic rifle, that meant that those bullets could penetrate their police armor. And in our documentary, you hear one of the officers say, essentially, if he had an AR, he was going to take us out. Whoever went first was going to be taken out. And that is something that we need to understand, that Texas lawmen were afraid of the AR-15. It's why they weren't able, I mean, they're going to say it was because of lack of coordination and such, but you are trained in a school shooting, in a mass shooting, you move in, you don't wait. They waited 77 minutes.
I want to talk about the guns, and this is another clip from your documentary that's airing next week after Uvalde, Guns, Grief, and Texas Politics.
As the city's only pediatrician, Dr. Roy Guerrero has cared for many of Uvalde's children since they were babies.
So if anyone asks you, you're 3'6". Sound good?
And he's seen firsthand just how much damage the AR-15 can do.
So it's May 24th, 2022. Just talk to me about that morning.
So I get to the hospital. I know something's wrong because there's doctors and nurses running everywhere. There's a few people that are injured. They're stabilized. There's these kids with minor injuries. And then you start to wonder, where's everybody else? So I asked one of the nurses, all these kids I see here, is this everyone that's here? They're like, no, there's some deceased children in the back. So they took me back there, and that's truly when I realized the caliber of what these weapons can do to a child's body. So imagine a child who's decapitated. That's it. What else do I have to tell you? Huge chest wounds where it seems like, you know, someone bore a hand through the whole chest. The only consolence I have to myself is maybe it was so fast that they didn't have time to suffer, that they went quickly, maybe not peacefully, but quickly.
I mean, you're reduced to saying that to parents.
Mm-hmm. What else can I do? Because I couldn't have done anything for them that day. Nothing. There's people saying, well, maybe we should show the mortuary pictures of these kids that were taken after they passed. Pictures of these kids in their coffins, pictures of the funerals.
Emmett Till's mother made a decision to have an open casket.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of changed history.
Maybe that's what it takes. Whether you want to believe it or not, this is what happened that day. These type of weapons, they're able to inflict so much damage and death so quickly and ferociously compared to other weapons. And if you turn 18 in Texas, you can go buy one tomorrow.
What do you want to see immediately? I mean, is there something tangible that you're like, at a minimum?
Ultimately, what I would want is a ban. That's the ultimate goal, which I know I'm not going to get. I think it's going to take a few brave people at the state level to where we can start to get our voices heard.
That's Uvalde's only pediatrician, as you describe in your documentary After Uvalde, Dr. Roy Guerrero. So he knew almost every child. And if you could continue on that point that he is raising, because it is such a critical one, as this country knows more than one mass shooting every day this year, is the issue is what gets shown. It's too gruesome, they say, to show this. He's talking about children, fourth graders decapitated. Will it take what Emmett Till, mother Mamie Till Mobley did, showing the images, show the pictures? What are parents and loved ones saying about this, Maria, in addition to Dr. Guerrero?
Yeah, Amy, look, this is such a difficult, painful conversation, and I do want to just take a moment for and to show a moment of respect for every parent who's had to deal with this, right? This is a very personal decision, right? And so much surrounded by trauma, right? So I don't want to be flip about something like this. This is very, very powerful conversations that we need to have in our country. And I did see the movie Till, actually, on my way down to Texas. It's a beautiful movie that looks at what Mrs. Till did in making that decision to have the open casket, which changed history. I will tell you that after the things that I saw, Amy, I'm sorry, the things that I saw, Amy, I said, these images should be shown to everyone. Everyone needs to see what I have seen, because if you saw this, there would be a massive uprising of people to say, no more. We have got to stop it. That was my personal reaction. We cannot force any parent to go through that. But the point here, actually, Amy, is that the parents of the kids in Uvalde, Texas, are being denied all the access to all of that footage, everything. Now, when you are a parent or a relative of somebody who is died like on September 11th or in a tragic way, it becomes a bit of an obsession to know everything about what happened. And so there are parents in Uvalde who want to see everything. They are being denied that by the district attorney and other members of Texas politics. And that's incorrect. They are the parents. They should have access to that before anyone sees that. And then they will... Well, they don't have access, but then they could make the decision about whether or not these images should be shown. So in many ways, the denial of this footage for them is a way of keeping them, in my view, this is very personal, keeping them from making that decision, keeping them from exposing these things. These are horrific things. The AR, the assault weapon, is a killing machine. It is a weapon of war. And as Caitlin's mom says, my daughter was in school, but she was confronted with a war machine. How do you understand this? And I'll quote, actually, Dr. Guerrero, who's an extraordinary human being and an activist as well now in Uvalde, who said, if there was something in our community, it was a car, it was an animal, it was an amusement park ride, it was a ball, if there was something that was in your community that was killing children, everyone would do something to say, get that out of my community. And yet, these weapons are available and accessible legally to an 18-year-old just like this shooter in Uvalde, Texas.
Maria Hinojosa, we're going to leave it there, but of course we'll continue to cover this issue. Maria is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, founder of Futuro Media, which has produced the new documentary she anchors for Frontline, together with Futuro Media and the Texas Tribune, that's premiering Tuesday, May 30th, titled After Uvalde, Guns, Grief, and Texas Politics. Coming up, as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis prepares a run for the White House, we'll look at Florida's right turn on immigration, a fierce anti-immigrant law that's now going into effect under DeSantis. Stay with us. Gutierrez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we look at the sweeping anti-immigrant crackdown in Florida, led by the Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, expected this week to announce his candidacy for the 2024 presidential race. The American Civil Liberties Union Monday filed a lawsuit against Florida over a new property law signed by DeSantis that restricts immigrants from buying homes in the state if they're born in China, and also targets those from Cuba, Venezuela, Syria, Iran, Russia, and North Korea. The ACLU says the new law, quote, harkens back to the anti-Asian land laws of the past century. Those laws violated the fundamental right to equal protection, just like Florida's does. The legislation takes effect July 1st, along with another anti-immigrant law that LULAC, that's the League of United Latin American Citizens, has called hostile and dangerous, and prompted it to issue a travel advisory for the state, along with the NAACP. The law bans people who are undocumented from using driver's licenses issued in other states and prohibits state ID cards to be issued to them. It requires hospitals that accept Medicaid to ask about people's citizenship status during intake, which could stop undocumented community members from seeking medical care. It also expands requirements for employers to use the federal E-Verify system to check the immigration status of their workers. Immigrant farm workers and others have walked off the job in protest of the new law.
It is very sad and unfortunate. They called us today because the painters and the people who do the cement all went to work in another state.
In other videos on social media, truck drivers are calling for boycotts of Florida over its new anti-immigrant law.
I don't know about you guys, but my truck will not be going to Florida at all. If we all came together as one community for Rogel Aguilera when he was facing injustice, I'm pretty sure we can all come together as a Latino community and boycott Florida as a whole. Because what they're doing to our brothers and sisters out there is not fair.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Florida, Andrea Reyes is an immigration attorney based in Jacksonville. She's featured in the new piece by Geraldo Cadava for The New Yorker magazine, headlined Florida's Right Turn on Immigration. Cadava is a professor of history and Latino studies at Northwestern University, author of The Hispanic Republican, The Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Andrea Reyes, I want to begin with you in Jacksonville, and thank you both so much for joining us. If you can talk about exactly what this new law lays out, including someone can be arrested for driving an undocumented migrant across state lines?
Yes, thank you for having me. So SB 1718 has been the harshest immigration bill that we have seen, harsher than the series of immigration bills that we saw back in 2010, 2011 with the Arizona bill under Jan Brewer. But what it originally was designed to do was actually a lot more draconian than what the final bill ended up being. And that's what's created a lot of fear and havoc in our immigrant communities on a state and local level. Originally, the bill was supposed to criminalize anybody that was helping, basically transporting, harboring, housing an undocumented immigrant in their home. They could be subject to up to a 15-year penalty. The final bill provision actually states specifically that a person who drives into the state of Florida an undocumented immigrant, and really there's a very specific word, and it's an immigrant who entered without inspection. So the state bill itself uses the word inspection, and in federal law under the INA, there is a very specific definition for inspection that does not match the state definition of inspection in the bill. So there's a lot of controversy, and we expect to see a lot of controversy with that specific provision because it is very vague and overbroad. As you stated in your introduction, the bill also does require hospitals to provide hospitals who receive Medicaid to report quarterly reports to the governor's office and to the legislature about the immigrants that are receiving assistance in their hospitals. However, what's very tricky about that bill is that there's a provision, and it's specifically written into the bill that allows for the hospitals to select decline to answer. So immigrants are actually allowed, you know, they're going to be able to decline to answer that citizenship question. But of course, right, you're telling immigrants who naturally don't seek a lot of medical attention as it is because they don't want to accumulate the bills, they don't want the attention, they don't want, you know, people asking questions about their immigration status. Now they're going to ask those questions despite the fact that they have an opportunity to decline to answer. So inherently, there's going to be a lot of fear in that as well. Another big provision of the bill is that, as you know, there are about 19 states and the District of Columbia that provide licenses to undocumented immigrants. And so there's a lot of immigrants currently in the state of Florida that have lived in other locations or have families in different states, and they've been able to obtain licenses from other states. This bill is now going to make it so that if an immigrant is stopped and they have a driver's license from another state, the police officer can exercise their authority as if the person was driving without a license, which means they can ticket them and or they can arrest them. So, I mean, those are like the big three things as well. You know, there's the section for non-citizens who potentially have their bar license right now are not going to be able to continue having their license, I believe, starting November 1st, 2028. So we have a lot of DACA recipients, as we know, who it's not a permanent legal solution to their status, but it does provide some stability through work permits and Social Security for them to be able to stabilize their lives. But so a lot of these individuals who are not U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents will no longer be able to hold licenses. It also creates a provision for law enforcement to have to mandatory cooperate with ICE on any any programs that where an undocumented immigrant might be processed. So there's a lot of things in this provision and in this bill. And what makes it really terrifying is the amount of provisions that it had. A lot of the previous bills that we've seen have focused on two, three, four items. This, you know, had, I think, over 12 provisions that directly affect immigration.
Geraldo Calava, you have written a book on the Hispanic Republican. Clearly, you have Ron DeSantis preparing to run for president, and he feels this will help him, whether we're talking about the abortion ban he just signed or when he says this is where woke goes to die, Florida, and the Don't Say Gay bill. And now you have this immigration law that's going into effect. It seems to be pillars of his platform. Can you talk about why he feels, with a large Latino population in Florida, this will help him win a national audience. Talk about the makeup of Florida and also Latino Republicans.
Yeah, that's a great question, Amy. And I just want to say thank you for having me on. I also want to say quickly, Andrea, it's nice to meet you here. I mean, we spoke while I was writing the piece, but we had never met. And so I just want to say that you're the one doing the work on the ground, and I'm just reporting on it. So it's nice to see you here, and thank you for the work you're doing. So I definitely think that this bill is related to Ron DeSantis's presidential ambitions. I mean, I think he probably correctly perceives that the national mood, especially within his own party, is against making it easier for immigrants and asylum seekers to settle in the United States. And so he thinks that if he can show that to be true, to be that he's doing something to be effective on immigration in his own state, he might also become a good national leader on this issue as well. But I think it could be a miscalculation. I mean, Florida is in some ways unique. He has, through gerrymandering and voting restrictions, engineered this situation in Florida where he has 28 Republican senators and only 12 Democrats. And so he can push through almost anything he wants to push through. But I'm not sure that what he's trying to do in Florida will translate nationally and, in fact, gain him wide acceptance on a national level. I think Florida's Latino communities are somewhat different than other Latino communities. I mean, historically, they've thrown their support to the Republican Party for a long time, for decades. And in November of 2022, 58% of Latinos voted for Ron DeSantis, even despite the airlifts to Martha's Vineyard and other places. So I think that in Florida, you have a much more conservative Latino population. I think what's interesting there lately is that it's not just Cuban Americans and Venezuelans who are shifting their support to Republicans, but also Puerto Ricans and Colombians and others.
I mean, it's interesting you bring up the Martha's Vineyard trip, taking undocumented immigrants, people, asylum seekers, putting them in a plane, flying them to Martha's Vineyard. Andrea Reyes, I mean, they're talking about arresting people for driving with people who are undocumented. He flew them.
Yeah, I mean, it's hypocritical, right? We're saying that we can't have people come into the state, but we're going to take people out of other states to other jurisdictions. It's an overreach of his power as a state entity, and we know we believe that because of the overreach that he is, you know, doing through immigration. He's trying to enact immigration laws through state law. The U.S. Supreme Court has already ruled that the federal government has plenary power over immigration. And so only when the federal powers give, you know, any authority to the states can they actually implement anything related to immigration. So the fact that he's trying to create immigration enforcement through state policy is going to become a constitutional issue as well.
So you're an immigration lawyer, Andrea Reyes, and you've been doing this for a number of years, from Trump through Biden right now. What do you demand of the Biden administration, and how much power does Biden have right now in the face of these Republican governors, everyone from Abbott in Texas to DeSantis in Florida?
Yeah, so I think Geraldo and I actually spoke about this in the article. We can look at any president, we can look at any administration, and it's never going to be enough. Whatever a president does when it comes to the immigration world is never going to be enough because all they're doing is putting a Band-Aid on an open wound. You know, a president can't fix the problem, the broken, delayed, strict immigration system that we have. They can't fix it. In fact, our Constitution doesn't allow for it. Only Congress has the power to create the laws to fix these problems. And, you know, for decades, Congress has refused to act on sensible, common, you know, positive, sensible immigration reform. And we look at the DREAM Act, for example. The DREAM Act, the first version was created in 2001. That's 22 years ago. That's a whole college student that, you know, in terms of age, that we have not been able to come together. We've presented, I think, 11 or 12 versions of that Dreamers Act bill, and Congress has not been able to come together. I think the last time that we had a real chance at passing it was in 2010. But since then, you know, we've presented new bills and nothing's happened. This is the most likable, the most susceptible, the most deserving immigrant population, right? The Dreamers. And we can't get Congress to act on behalf of Dreamers. So at the end of the day, people need to understand that, yes, a president, when you go to vote for presidential elections, it matters. Absolutely. All elections matter. But that's the thing. People think that only presidential elections are going to fix their problems, when really, especially for immigrant populations, right, the Congress, the Senate, our senators and our elected representatives are the ones that have the power to build and create the laws that we need to protect us. And so I think a big part of this movement that's going to come forward as a result of SB 1718 is all these young Latinos, I'm hoping anyways, the same thing that happened after Arizona in 2010, you know, we're going to have all these young, vibrant Latino nonprofit organizations, grassroots movers, you know, kind of teaching and educating the population on not just like what our political system looks like, but number one, you have to leave your baggage behind from your country. Whatever happened in your country is in your country and that has a different constitutional order. Here in the United States, we have we have separate concepts that really help us. Separation of powers, right? What saved us during the Trump administration were the federal courts. Federalism, this idea of like what is plenary power for the federal government, what is state power. So if we can educate the immigrant population, if we can get voters registered, you know, if we can get people to register for voting, I think in the state of Florida, if I'm not, I might misquote it, but I think there's like a 40% of current permanent legal residents are eligible to vote, and they haven't registered to vote because A, they don't, the English, right, that is always an issue, but also they don't trust the system and they don't believe in our way of government because sometimes they're stuck on how their government operated in their home country.
I wanted to bring Professor Cadava back into the conversation. We only have about a minute, but you speak to Jose Rodriguez, a priest in Florida, who says many conservative Latino voters are prioritizing anti-abortion laws over immigration. And if you can talk about that and whether you think that will change as this becomes more and more extreme.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was interested in exploring is how this law might be seen by religiously motivated Latinos. And I was thinking that the bill would kind of pull them in different directions because, on the one hand, they've long supported immigrant rights and the idea that immigrants are neighbors and members of our community, at the same time that they are increasingly kind of supporting anti-abortion bills and Ron DeSantis's other pretty radically conservative legislation. So when I spoke with Jose Rodriguez, I wanted to understand how the Latinos he works with see this bill. And he was saying that he thinks that conservative Latinos are now prioritizing anti-abortion because they've kind of gone all in on the conservative movement. But he thinks that it could have it could have a lot of blowback or a lot of negative consequences for them as well once they realize all of the negative effects of the immigration bill as well. So he thinks that right now conservative Latinos are just elevating the anti-abortion issue over the immigration issue.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. Professor Geraldo Cadava, we thank you for being with us, Professor of History and Latino Studies at Northwestern University in Chicago. We'll link to your piece in The New Yorker magazine, Florida's Right Turn on Immigration. And thank you to Andrea Reyes, an immigration attorney, speaking to us from Jacksonville, Florida. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, we are Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.